I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The money moves in such small amounts, it's easy to think that it doesn't matter. It might be $200 or $300 wired by a recent immigrant in the United States, but when that money is collected by a friend or family member in Tegucigalpa or Guadalajara or Lagos, it can make an enormous difference. These kinds of remittances have gone on for years. For many newcomers to America, it's not a choice, it's their duty to help out the people back home. Until very recently, no one paid much attention to the steady stream of Western Union wires, but then someone did the math. It turns out that tallied altogether, the amount of remittance money being wired now is somewhere near or well over $100 billion a year. So now the big banks are interested. They want to lure those $100 wires away from Western Union to get those people inside the Bank of America, for example, opening accounts, getting loans, buying homes. It fits in with the president's overall plan to make the illegal economy more a part of daily business in the U.S. But many of the recent immigrants don't trust banks. So what needs to change? Is the system working well right now, or is it time that the practice of wiring money back home be taken out of the small Western Union booth and into the bright lights of a big bank? How do you see this? Is this part of a larger government plan to tighten up on the shadow economy? Will you use the banks to send money back home? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start with Dufour Florisson. He's joining us on the line from his office in Mattapan, Massachusetts. He's a loan officer, investment representative, insurance broker who now runs his own business, Kiki Financial Services. Dufour, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been here in the United States since the early 80s, I understand.
Absolutely.
And sending money home pretty well ever since then?
Ever since I came to the U.S. Back in New York, started working, and then I started sending an average of $100, $200, including the $300 that's every month to my parents in Haiti.
You ever sat down and added it all up to figure out how much you've sent over that 22, 23 years?
I never did that. I never had just an opportunity to do that. The fact that I know that's my responsibility, it's an obligation for me just to help out back home. To the fact that unemployment is so high and I had the opportunity being in this country, having the opportunity to work, so it's okay for me to do it, not counting how much that I sent. And this is the norm also for most of our people living in the United States to send money back home.
Now, do you use Western Union or PayPal or one of these organizations?
No, we use our own transfer agencies in our community, just such as Unitransfer, CAM, or Brothers, and some other known Haitian business transfer. That's what. And the reason we use them is the fact that the system they put in place in Haiti is a door-to-door delivery due to the security reasons. So they have people working for them to go from door-to-door to deliver the transfer. And that's really just put people over here at ease and not to put their family in jeopardy while they have to go to a transfer agency and wait to get the money delivered to them.
Dufour, was that any of your monthly payments ever lost, gone missing?
No, that's never happened. All the money always get there safely. And I would say lately, back just a year ago, there is another program that's developed by one of the transfer agency with the Uni Transfer that's transferred the money directly back to anyone that have an account in a bank in Haiti, but understand that not so many people have an account open in Haiti. And
right.
Also that alleviate also the fees they're paying. It started about 9% interest, and a 9% basically fee that you have to pay to send the money back home.
So it costs you $10. They're about $10 to send $100 to Haiti. That's a fair amount of money.
About it. It's a costly just to send that $100. But the program that Uni Transfer works is the fact that they started at a 6% if you transfer the money directly to your bank account, and they decreased it, I believe, that's up to 3% now, depending on the amount that you are sending. And lately also, there's another organization that's worked closely with the Haitian organization, especially the Haitian churches, which is a Greater Boston Faith organization. As you mentioned before, about the big bank that wants to get involved into this transfer money. They're working with a test pilot program with Citizens Bank to charge a flat fee when their members send some money to Haiti.
Do you think people would be interested in these new pilot programs, these new cheaper ways of sending money?
What I understand, I believe that, but the people will be they will stick with the Haitian businesses, as I told you, due to the fact that the money is being transferred directly to their parents' home, door to door. It's a delivery, free delivery in Haiti. I don't know that if those banks will be able to offer the same services by going door to door and delivered. I believe that the banks will be able to transfer the money directly to an account in Haiti, but I don't think they have the means basically just to go and deliver a door to door in the suburb. I mean, not in the suburb, just around the mountains. You know, people live in a third world country where it's not too accessible with transportation. Then in motorcycles, I think it were probably too costly for them just to get involved. But they can if the people just have a bank account. But most likely, I know the majority of the people will be using Haitian transfer agencies because of the services.
Dufour, just a quick last question here. You're, as I said at the beginning, a loan officer, an investment representative now. Do you think that the people who are recent arrivals in the United States should be making more use of banks and ways of managing the money here? Because people tend to get pretty nervous about filling out those forms and that sort of thing.
I believe that people are more afraid right now of to go to the bank due to the Patriot Act, the legality of things, the papers they need to provide, because some of them don't have the document, the necessary paperwork to provide at the bank. I think people will still be staying away from banks unless banks develop all the educational program to educate the people about the system, how they can help them, and it's not going to be a threat to their livelihood around here.
Dufour, thanks a lot for being with us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dufour Florissant is an independent businessman running his own business, Kiki Financial Services. I want to switch over to our NPR studios in Washington now. And joining us from there, Don Terry. He's a manager at the Inter-American Development Bank, keeping a close eye on remittances, especially with expertise in Latin America. Don, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you. And Dimitrios Papadimitriou is... also there, he's president of the Migration Policy Institute. Dimitrios, thanks for coming in.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, I checked your bio yesterday. You came to America as a young man from Greece, speaking very little English. Who was sending money to who at that time? Were you sending it home? Was your father sending money to you?
I think that's an unfair question. I think my father was probably sending some money to me for the first 4 or 5 years.
You came to study, right?
I came to study, so it's a different path than whatever the average might be.
I
can say that I never had to send money back home.
I look at the figures, though, Dimitri. 40% of immigrants sending money back home. Don can give us more detail on the figures, but it's quite staggering.
It is staggering. It's a great deal of money. The World Bank estimated a couple of years ago that $111 billion were transferred. The figure is probably a bit of an understatement. I suspect now we're probably talking about somewhere in the $120-130 billion, two and a half times as much money as we give in foreign aid. The entire world gives in foreign aid. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, a lot of that money goes from point to point. People emigrate, they take the chances, they work hard, and they send the money back where it matters most for them, which is to their family, to their household.
Don Terry, your expertise in Latin America, I saw a number that said it was close to $40 billion going just from the United States to Latin American countries. Is that pretty close to how you understand it?
That's absolutely the number, and as Dimitrios said, that's probably somewhat of an undercount. But we think in Latin America and the Caribbean, we have a pretty good sense of this because we've been involved for the past 5 years or so trying to get our arms around this. And we were extremely surprised when we first started. Everybody knew that there was money going to Mexico and to El Salvador and to Dominican Republic and to Haiti. But it turns out that it's going to most of the countries in Latin America and the Caribbean in substantial amounts. And then more recently, we did a survey in the United States, and it turns out that it's not just going from the border states of California and Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and the rest, but really it's almost every state in the United States. According to our survey, there's 37 states in the United States plus the District of Columbia that send substantial amounts of money to Latin America every year.
Why are the banks interested now, Don? What's drawing their attention? Is it just the opportunity to make those fees in helping transfer that money?
Well, I think that's right. I think what first attracts people, obviously, is the enormous volume.
Yeah.
But if you're a bank in the United States, I also think if you're thinking into the future, not only is the Latin American population, the Latino population in the United States, now the number one minority group, but if you project out a little bit, over 20% of the school-age population in the United States, elementary and high school kids, mm-hmm. are Latino. And so if you want, in the future, if you want people who are going to be savings and doing the rest with your banks, you better start figuring out a way of connecting with the Latino population in the United States.
And Demetria, part of the Migration Policy Institute study has been on just how far behind the U.S. is other countries in figuring out a way to make this transfer of money work easily, isn't it?
Yes, quite so. For a space, a physical space or a political space that has been in the immigration business forever, at least 600 years, if you count, you know, the first official visitors to this part of the world, and certainly our country that has been in this business for 200 and some years, is quite remarkable to me. It's puzzling that we just seem to have discovered remittances. I mean, Don and the work that he has done and the work that he has funded put both on the policy and the political table an issue that is essentially something that truly motivates both countries and individuals that engage in immigration throughout the rest of the world. So none of these kinds of things that we're finally beginning to have a conversation about in North America would be strange to the Gulf states or to South Asia or to the Philippines or, for that matter, Europe and all of the countries that contribute immigrants to Europe. One significant difference, I suspect, and that may account for the fact that we've come late to this game, is that in many of these places, banks have indeed been the principal mechanism or conduit for the transfer of funds, because migration to these parts of the world has been legal, authorized, and often temporary, even if it turns out to be permanent, often temporary. So constantly, people go back and forth. People emigrate in order to be able to help their homes and their households back home. In the United States, an awful lot of what it is that we do in immigration is unauthorized, which creates opportunities for some of the other non-bank ways of transferring these funds.
Now, Demetria, let me just stop you there. We have to take a short break, but a chance for me to remind our listeners we're talking about the wiring of money from the United States to people back home, and the point that this is not just a question of policy and bank policy, but it's also politics, and takes us into a closer understanding of just how immigration in the United States is different from other countries. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour we're talking about the remarkable amount of money which moves from this country into developing countries, not so necessarily developing countries in some cases, but always and most often moving through Western Union as people, recent immigrants to the United States, send money to friends and family back home, much of it not through banks, but through Western Union and other small agencies which are specific to those countries. And the banks are eyeing that transaction. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our first call from Boston. Eve is joining us. Hello, Eve.
Yes, good morning. Great show, Dick.
Thanks.
You know, 2 points, you know, I would like, you know, to add it this morning. The money now we send, you know, I'm from Haiti. Now, the money we send to Haiti, according to the last survey done here in Boston, it's about, you know, $800 million a year we send back home to Haiti. But most of the money come back here to United States. because the reason why the money come back here, most of the stuff, you know, our people living in Haiti, they have to buy with this money, are not, you know, stuff produced in Haiti, clothes or food, you know. Those products are done here, are produced here in the United States. Basically, the money comes back here to, you know, United States.
Eve, let me ask you, though, if the local bank said, look, we want you to use our bank, we don't want you to go to these other agencies, would you go to the bank to send the money to Haiti?
No. I have, you know, a different reason, you know, for not, you know, using the big banks. The big banks, you know, they are not involved in locally or in Haiti in community development work. Let's take, you know...
But who cares about that, Eve? If all they're doing is helping get the money back to Haiti, why do they need to be involved in local work back home?
For us, you know, let's take, you know, the Haitian living in Boston, it's very important for us because, you know, those small company, let's say, you know, I have a book fair to organize for, you know, young Haitian kids. I can go to any, you know, small, you know, local transfer in the Asian community, and they will give some money to help us, you know, to organize, like, you know, any community work. Meanwhile, you know, the big banks, what they do, they just, you know, take our money. They do business with us.
Okay, but hang on a second, Eve. I want to hear from Don Terry here because this speaks specifically to one of the reservations, Don, that people are expressing about making this shift. What do you think?
Well, I think Eve is historically absolutely correct. Let's be direct and honest. Banks historically have not been interested in the types of people who send and receive remittances. There's no question about that. They are getting interested because of the volume, as I said, and because, at least in the United States, of the growing populations that are coming from other parts of the world. Now, the banks haven't been interested in this population, but the population back home doesn't trust these banks either. And so that is why 100 million times a year from the United States to Latin America, there is a remittance transfer. And percentage-wise, very few of those, certainly less than 5% of those remittances go through a formal financial institution. But what we would like to do as a development institution is give the people who are sending and particularly receiving, because we work in Latin America, we want to give them more options with their money. And one of the options that you can't get, unfortunately, if you send it through a money transfer company, it is convenient, it is fast, it is reliable, it is costly. But one of the things that you don't get on the other end is the opportunity for a savings account, an opportunity for a small loan. And so it is true that historically banks on both sides of this equation have not been interested in these populations, but we are hoping that that can change. In fact, we're using the term financial democracy. We want to open up the financial systems in these countries, and we're starting slowly. We're starting with microfinance institutions, credit unions in Latin America, and particularly in places like El Salvador and Honduras and Ecuador and Mexico. And we're seeming to get some resonance with that, and people are sending some of their money back to those institutions. Bank of America, Citibank, they don't need us. They'll figure it out on their own,
yeah,
or not figure it out on their own.
Let me bring Dan Stein into the conversation. Dan is with the Federation for American Immigration Reform. And Dan, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Your organization raises questions about the number of people who come to the United States. What do you think about the move to making it a little bit easier to get money flowing from the U.S. to some of these home countries?
Well, you know, after the fact, I guess it's being viewed as a rationale for promoting massive, poorly controlled immigration, that it's an alternative form of foreign aid. But when I look at the overall aggregate picture, what I see is that a lot of countries are losing their most ambitious and motivated and entrepreneurial people to the United States, that while they're sending money back home, that's now become some kind of a rationale for the idea that those countries somehow would not have been better off if they had been persuaded to retain and try to hold on to that talent.
But the work's not there.
Well, the point is, if you're going to try to attract foreign capital, you're going to need to, any country is going to need to hold on to its bright, talented, and ambitious people.
Okay, let me, if I can, Dan, just bring it to the point that we're talking about here. If the transfer of money from the United States back to those countries is brought more into the sort of international financial system that we're talking about, isn't that bringing it more into the open, less of a sort of shadow economy?
Well, the banks themselves are working very diligently to try to get into this market because, as you pointed out, you know, money, greed, they have a financial interest in the transaction costs. But that's not an excuse for the banks to be part of a process of winking at the actual legality of the status of the alien, which particularly last year was a big battle over Treasury Department regulations because, you know, the major banks did not want to be responsible for verifying both the identity and the legality of the status of the person trying to open the account. And that puts the banks in the positions of being a facilitator, if you will, an enabler of a process of illegal immigration, which is something that we find highly objectionable. If we're going to promote foreign aid, I want to do it democratically through Congress and establishing foreign aid programs, not have foreign governments coming up to the U.S. arguing that we should promote more mass immigration because it lets a corrupt government thrive on the hard mm-hmm. currency sent back as an alternative to economic reform.
Let me hear from Demetrios here. Do you see this as a form of foreign aid, Demetrios?
Well, in a certain way, it is, has always been that. It's nice to hear Dan being so concerned about all of these sending countries, etc., and that's a legitimate sentiment. And in addition to that, in an ideal world, I suspect that what Dan Stein is talking about would probably be the way that we should be doing our business. In the real world in which we all live, immigration indeed has been a means through which people of talent, of ambition, of, you know, people who are willing to work very hard, going to another place, doing well there without forgetting their responsibilities back home. And I think since Dan opened the question of the larger question about immigration, it is not only capital, meaning money that these people send back. We seem to be forgetting in this conversation issues of social and political remittances, the opportunity to transfer back through the movement of people, the visits, the going back and forth, or the going back to settle. Historically, between 40% and 60% of all immigrants to the United States have gone back to their country. Historically, and even today, in shorter periods of time, if you look at any 10-year period, you will find about 25% to 35% of the people who go back. This is part of really transferring more than just money. It's transferring a way of life, democratic ideals, the relationship of how the governed should relate to the government, etc., etc. Migration is an extremely important component through which the world grows.
Dan, back to you.
Well, those are all very nice mystic sentiments Dimitri's very good at talking about. But look, as an American citizen, I see the process as one of draining money out of the economy, where when you bring in foreign workers whose skills are substitutes for American workers, then by ipso facto, they erode the bargaining leverage of American workers in the same position. If you add the costs associated with providing taxpayer services for education, housing, various remedial education programs, and health care, the list goes on and on, and then you look at all this money being sent out of the country instead of being recirculated, and it's not true, I think, as that caller said, that the money is put back into this country buying consumer products. Many of these products are now made in other countries. It's a real legitimate question why we would want to promote a transfer of wealth out of this country under the conditions that are actually harming the most vulnerable American working middle-class and lower-class American workers.
All right, Don Terry, one's from you on whether or not it is this transfer that Dan is describing.
Let me provide some facts instead of rhetoric, I guess. There are just over 16 million Latin Americans who were born in Latin America now living in the United States. Of them, about 60% send money home on a regular basis. That money accounts this year, we estimated, about $30 billion. This is out of a total of $450 billion that those people will earn in the United States. So about 7% of the money that is earned in the United States will leave in the form of remittances. That's a significant amount of their individual resources. But nationally, the overwhelming majority stays in the United States. It is, however, back home, 50 to 80% of the income of that family. And so what is a significant sacrifice in this country is absolutely critical back home. But I think it is also important to make the point this is not an alternative to foreign aid. This is family to family. Foreign assistance, it seems to me, is for public goods. This is a very personal relationship. It's part of the globalization process. It seems to me that you're not going to have a free flow of goods and trades and services, free flow of technology, free flow of capital, and not have the free flow of people. I understand that the immigration laws haven't kept up with this reality. But the fact is that people are going to go where the jobs are. There is no indication that they are taking jobs away from American citizens at this point. In fact, to the contrary, for most of these states that are sending substantial amounts of money back home, those economies in those states would be hard put if all of the Latinos were to leave. In fact, there's a new movie out that's being shown in Texas and in California, and it's called A Day Without a Mexican. And the premise is, what happens one morning if you wake up and all of the Mexicans have left? And, of course, the answer is the state of California, the economy, the society implodes.
Don, let me stop you there. I want to bring Maria into the conversation. She's joining us now on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Maria.
How are you?
I'm fine. Tell me what you think about what you're hearing here.
Yes, I work for Acción International, and the comment I wanted to make is that I agree. With the market research we've done shows that families in Latin America pull together resources to send a member of their family to the U.S.
Right.
They come to the U.S. and work 2-3 jobs each day. And what we're seeing is that these families stay connected, and the immigrant tries to pursue a life here and a life back home. They try to continue to help their families back home by sending remittances and are pursuing investment goals both here in the U.S., trying to get a home, trying to settle down, as well as to help their families that were left back home. So I wanted to point to the fact that what we're doing in Latin America is we are working with banks. They're not the largest banks in each country, but they are formal banks and microfinance institutions that are offering financial products to this low-income market.
Maria, what do you say to Dan Stein when he says that this transfer of money from the United States to these families back home ends up being quite a substantial drain on this country's economy?
I would say that the first thing we found is that people, their main goal after 5 years in the U.S. is still to go back, and they want to pursue and build a house back home or help their families be less dependent on them so that they could try to go back. But the other thing that we have to realize is that immigrants are doing jobs that nobody else is doing in the U.S. People are cleaning bathrooms in congressional offices, and these are immigrants. And this is not a draining of money. I think people also try to get their families here in the U.S., build a home, settle down. These are people that, the same as everybody else, are just trying to get their families in a better future for them.
Okay, Maria, quick last question for you, though. How does this country improve the system of shifting that money? Is it working the way as well as it should right now, or is it time for the big banks to get involved, for government regulation to make it a little bit easier?
I agree. I think it's time for big banks to get involved. We're trying on our side to bank the recipient so that then in the future we can work with partner banks and partner institutions such as credit unions as well to bank the sender as well.
All right, Dan. Maria, thanks for the call. Dan Stein, back to you. Part of what we're talking about here reminds me of the president's consideration of the Foreign Workers Program, where he was supposedly going to introduce legislation that made it easier for people to move back and forth, to move money back and forth. The point keeps being made that I need you to address is that a lot of this has to do with people who are returning home, people building up their family or their business in the country that they come from.
Well, of course, you know, these debates are all overlaid on the current security-related issues involving the government's inability to monitor who's here, to actually understand the identity of who they're dealing with, to ensure departure control with an immigration system that has been so chaotic that Congress actually had to abolish the old Immigration Service and then merge it into the new Department of Homeland Security. But it's, I mean, it's, I think it would be intellectually dishonest to not admit that the use of remittances sent back home to families overseas also can help fuel migration of people who, without those remittances, would not have had the capability of making the trip to the United States.
Do you mean legal or illegal migration?
Both. I mean, both, ultimately. There has been, as the remittance level has increased, the level of immigration has also increased. So this, there used to be this theory, well, we couldn't control immigration until we made everything wonderful for people in Latin America. And as we've continued to try to pump foreign aid in, improve trade relations, we passed NAFTA. Now we're talking about the Free Trade of the Americas Agreement, and as we've allowed the remittance level to grow, the immigration flow has continued to pace, both legal and illegal.
So you're saying don't make it easier to move money, make it harder for people to move money out of the United States.
Well, there are several great predictors of future immigration, which is, what is the income differential? Have you had a lot of recent immigrants come from that same country? And are they sending money and information back home that helps inflate the expectations of people who'd like to follow in their footsteps? And that's what's exactly happened. So there's, you know, in the end, the question is, what is the most profitable way of helping these countries develop prosperous and strong economies for the future? I seriously doubt that we're going to be looking to Wells Fargo and Bank of America for that lesson, because their interest in this is purely mercenary. They're simply trying to find a way to get in on the action without regard to whether they're compromising the security interests or the immigration laws of this country.
It is not just policy. It certainly has a lot to do with politics. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about this further. Dan Stein, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Take care.
Dan is Executive Director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Don Terry remains with us. He's a manager at the American Development Bank. And Dimitrios Papadimitriou is in charge of the, is president of the Migration Policy Institute. We're going to talk more about this idea of moving money out in ways that are simpler, getting the big banks involved, maybe simplifying government regulations. What are the politics involved here, and what are your own thoughts about it? Would you quite happily go to the Bank of America to move money back to a Latin American country? Are you quite happy with the anonymity of the Western Union booth? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Is the system of moving money from this country to friends and family in countries back home working well right now? Is it time that the large banks brought their competitive edge to this, perhaps handing out ATM cards, other ways of shifting money around? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you in on our conversation this hour. I want to turn to Dimitrios Papadimitriou on one point that hasn't been raised, but Dimitri, it's come up before, and that is that over the years people have fretted about the money going out of North America, saying that, oh, it's going to fund terrorism or rebellions or civil wars. It's flowing through the hands of Sri Lankans or Afghans or Pakistanis or Sikhs in this country. And I don't know whether or not it's misleading to even sort of mark that as one thing that needs to be addressed. I know it's something that politicians pause and talk about.
Well, it's certainly in the post 9/11 environment, this is certainly one of the considerations that we have to take into account. But let's not forget that this is a minuscule proportion of the overall total. And this kind of sort of support either from the outside in order to sort of get things done back home, whether politically or anything like that, goes back in history. The Greek Revolution, the one that created the independent Greek state in the 1820s from Turkey, was financed entirely by wealthy Greeks in Russia. And you can actually find 10, 15, 100 different historical examples where indeed the diaspora, the community of expatriates, have also done this thing. But this is an infinitesimally small part of the total. I think the government is right to be paying attention to these issues and to be asking the right kinds of questions in places where this is a legitimate concern.
Okay, but
for the rest, it is essentially a person-to-person, household-to-household relationship where money that is earned through the hard work of these individuals goes and helps people back at the household. All the studies that we've done the last 30 or 40 years, practically in every part of the world, indicate that about two-thirds of all of the remitted earnings are spent on household expenses, building houses, buying televisions, you know, doing the kinds of things that advance the opportunities for the household, and much less directly, just as Don said, for perhaps the village.
Bring us then back to where we began this hour with the shift that is underway right now from the more traditional ways of shifting money to possible involvement of large banks and financial institutions. If you're to speak to someone who really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the bank and has some suspicions about that and doesn't want to fill out all the forms that might go along with registering for a checking account, how do you make the case that it's a smart thing for someone to do now instead of sort of staying with what's worked in the past?
Very gradually, I suspect, and very carefully. It is important that in the early stages we don't have any failures. In other words, you know, that we be conservative about it, that nobody loses their money, that nothing disappears in the process. But gradually, it seems to me that it's to the developmental aspirations, key to the developmental aspirations of all of these places to which remittances go, to begin to engage the entire financial services sector, the banking sector, in order for them to be able to make the investments, borrow funds, etc., that will help many of these households and communities to grow. This is, you know, something that Don, I'm sure, can address more completely than that. And it's also very consistent with what one of your speakers mentioned.
Well, Don, it's the point that you were making earlier, that if somebody wants to put some money in a bank account in New York and let the bank in Honduras know that it's there, then the family in Honduras can borrow against that amount and make better use of the money than just sort of seeing it transferred without a piece sliced off. That's the point you're making, isn't it?
I think that's right. I think that if we take the banks out of this equation just for a moment, I think there's two issues. One is technology. We want to give those people who are sending and receiving access as best possible to the same technology that really Dimitri or I or you or most of your listeners would use. We would never use the current system. If we had, let's say, a son or a daughter or studying abroad, we would not be going down to a money transfer company month after month after month after month to do that. And so we need to open up that type of technological possibilities to them. But we also, I think, need to help provide more options to these people. This is the way that they're going to be able to get their first loan, their first savings account. I remember in my family, growing up in Boston, actually, my first savings account, we took our first communion money and we put it into a savings account. That's how it started in our family. They don't have that culture, that history in Latin America and in much of the rest of the world, but I think that it is, in a way, almost immoral to continue to allow these poor people, these hardworking people who save and have this devotion to family, to use the most expensive way of sending money. At least let's give them the options of doing it.
Let's go back to our callers, to Needham, Massachusetts. Jane's on the line. Hi, Jane.
Yes, hi. I had several issues I wanted to address. The first one was with regard to the potential market comprised of these foreign workers that are here in the States.
Yeah.
I don't know the numbers on it, but there are many foreign workers in Massachusetts who are illegal. Now, these people work very hard. They are paying taxes, or at least their money is being, you know, signified to the government through false or incorrect Social Security numbers. And money is being deducted from their checks, and it's going into some black hole. I have personally, I'm an interpreter and I work closely with the Portuguese-speaking community. I have seen letters from the government saying, you know, this number on your Social Security payment is wrong. You know, please contact us and let's get this straight. So I'm assuming that there's a sinking fund somewhere of this money. No one ever talks about it.
But is this a backdoor fix to that, Jane? If in fact there are all these people who have made it to the country and are working and are illegal, is there a way of creating some kind of legitimacy by going at it through the financial system rather than through some sort of government long-involved, you know, green card and work permit approval system.
It occurs to me that in the long term, in the same way that when the EU was coming together to form a potential market against which America was going to have to compete, in the coming 10 to 15 years, the trading blocks of the world are going to be pretty well sketched out, where you're going to have North and South America, at least in trade, you know, it's going to be all opened up. And it seems to me that if the U.S. is going to compete in the long term, the work situation with just work permits needs to be opened up between all these countries in the U.S. so that the U.S. will be able to, along with Latin America, right, compete effectively with the emerging blocks of Asia and China. And I think that banks need to be there in D.C. lobbying the Congress for this, because these workers, if we didn't have these workers here, for example, in the state of Massachusetts, I guarantee you the economy of the state would go, you know, would completely slump away.
Okay, Dimitri, just quick from you then, is this a wedge? Are the banks providing the politicians with a wedge to move this along in the way that Jane's describing?
Well, certainly this is one way to think about it, but really what we have is the facts on the ground beginning to be heard in Washington. I mean, if there is one thing that we should take out of the president's announcement in January and then the Democratic response to that through a bill that they introduced about a month and a half ago, is indeed that we have now gotten to the point where all sorts of institutions in this country, from the labor unions, AFL-CIO back in the year 2000, to the banking sector, to police chiefs, to several states that accept all of these IDs as enough for them to issue driver's licenses, here, things on the ground have moved far ahead of where the politicians are in Washington. And the politicians have to follow through with something.
We're going to Nashville, Tennessee next. Walter's joining us on the line. Hi, Walter.
Hi, hello. The comment I have is basically I use usually like Western Union and MoneyGram to send money, but I tried using like Citibank because I have an account with Citibank and they were offering a service like international wire transfer. But the problem is it takes longer. Like with a Western Union and MoneyGram, you have the money in about 10 minutes. And
where are you sending the money, Walter?
Romania.
Yeah, I've tried sending money to Canada using the banking system, and you know it cost me like $25 and was going to take 3 days. Are they getting any better at it?
I don't know. I mean, like they seem to have. I don't know. Maybe they're offering it again, but they seem to have stopped. And the other problem was like you had to fill out a lot more information. Like you had to fill out the bank's your bank's routing number, the bank the receiving bank routing number. And also you had to, like, you know, the other person has to have an account, which is not always the case.
Right.
So it makes it a lot more complex. I mean,
if they got it right, Walter, would you use the bank?
Yeah, I think it would be convenient. I mean, I tried using it, like I said, and I prefer, because they had an internet form, I would prefer using the bank, because then I could do it without having to go to, like, Western Union or, you know, like a money order location. But it has to be convenient, and people have to be able to pick it up from anywhere, because that's the way it works with Western Union.
Like, right.
It doesn't have to be a specific bank. It could be just the closest location.
No point taking a bus 90 miles to a Citibank branch somewhere in Romania. Don Terry, are you taking notes, or do you know all this right now?
Well, I think it does illustrate the banks are just getting started at this. Again, the banks have never been interested in this type of population, and it's going to take them a while to figure it out. But they are figuring it out in some cases. I mean, you used previously the reference point to dual-use ATM cards. What you got to do is to get the people on the sending and the receiving side into an institution that will issue one of those pieces of plastic. But if you do that, the fastest, safest, quickest way to send money is not cash to cash. That's the money transfer system is essentially called cash to cash. But it's account to account. And once that's set up, then you can use the technology that's available to pretty much everybody in the United States, but it's pretty much not available to most of the people living in Latin America and the rest of the developing world.
So, Dimitri, what's the model? What country has got it right in terms of helping people move money both in and out?
Well, essentially, a lot of the European countries that have had long-term desk worker relations with the areas in the periphery of Europe have done it right, you know, they have it down pat. But I think Don's point that this is the beginning of a market that is developing, and that the demand very much will determine, and the amounts, of course, will very much determine how fast and how well the banking sector is going to respond to this, is the true answer here. There is no reason, the caller is right, for anyone to wait for 3 days for something that takes one, you know, a segment of a second, you know, for the transfer. And you can even spend an extra 10 minutes or so in order to meet all of the new government regulations about, you know, laundering money and what have you. The same kind of regulations that increasingly, I suspect, all of the other more private sector, you know, cash-to-cash companies will have to gradually get used to. So that creates opportunities for the people who save the money, for the people who send the money, and for the people that use the money.
But
so
challenges as well, though, Don Terry, for the banks in the way that they make themselves more user-friendly in dealing people with people who, you know, may not have English as a first language and all the things that have traditionally kept those people outside the bank doors.
Absolutely. But I do want to also mention this. It's one of my favorite points, actually, when I talk about remittances, because you've mentioned Bank of America, for instance. Bank of America started about 100 years ago in San Francisco Bay as the Bank of Italy.
Okay.
And one of the things that they did 100 years ago, along with other types of services like small loans and savings accounts, provided remittances services back to Italy. And then about 30 years later, because this was a very successful Bank of Italy, they bought out a bigger but less successful financially bank called the Bank of America. So literally, Bank of America started as Bank of Italy 100 years ago, and one of the things they did was help send remittances back home.
Back to the roots then. Thank you for your help on this, gentlemen. Interesting program. Don Terry, good of you to be with us.
Thank you very much.
Don is a manager at the Inter-American Development Bank, and Dimitrios Papadimitriou, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Dimitri is president of the Migration Policy Institute. A little bit earlier in the program, we talked with Dan Stein, executive director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Dufour Florissant, who runs Kiki Financial Services in Mattapan, Massachusetts. Our program is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugart. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.